This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When Tropical Storm Irene blew through in 2011, it took out the Vermont State Hospital in Waterbury. The state hospital had vexed governors for years. It was old. It had a bad reputation among a lot of patients. It frequently lost federal certification and the funds that went with that. So after the storm, by necessity, Vermont had to come up with a new plan. And a lot of attention has been paid to how the state of Vermont thinks mental health care should function. Governor Peter Shumlin has stressed that he thinks people should be able to be treated in or near their own communities. And so while there is a new psychiatric care hospital in Berlin, which has had its own struggles to remain fully staffed, the governor stresses that the community mental health system in each county will shoulder the bulk of outpatient treatment and recovery. But that's the state system. There are also hundreds of counselors, psychologists, and some psychiatrists who operate in private practice. And we don't hear much about how they fit into the overall picture of mental health care in Vermont. Many of them say they're essential to that network, treating people whose conditions might not be serious enough to be seen in designated community mental health centers, and providing treatment all over the state. But they can also be expensive, and some don't take insurance. We're going to look at that today on the show and talk with two independent providers who can help give us a lens into their world. Dr. Rick Barnett is a licensed psychologist and alcohol and drug counselor in Stowe. Hi, Rick. Nice to talk with you.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And Kevin Gallagher is a licensed clinical mental health counselor in Burlington. Kevin, it's a pleasure to have you on the show as well.
Thanks, Jane. Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Barnett, maybe you can just start by telling me what a typical day is like for you. Just give us a sense of what your work is like.
I usually start around 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning. I see patients for 45 minutes to an hour for general psychotherapy. About 40% of my practice is addiction related, but most of it's general mental health, running the range from, I would say, mild schizophrenia, thought disorders, which is rare to see in private practice, but I do have patients who have thought disorders, bipolar disorder, panic, anxiety disorders, and depression.
And you work, I mean, that'll take up a whole day, I imagine. You see a lot of patients?
I currently see about 35 to 40 patients a week, which is on the higher end for a private practitioner.
Kevin, what about for you? What's your work like?
Quite similar. I start about 7:30, getting to work and sort of getting my head organized for the day. And then I will see four clients in the morning. Might be families, might be couples, might be adolescents when it's summertime. 12 to 2 is the gym and lunch. So that's where I sort of get revived in the middle of the day. And then have anywhere from 2 to 4 more clients in the afternoon, finishing around 6. And then because I see a lot of adolescents and young adults, there's a lot of collateral work that goes on. So often between 7:30, I'm calling parents or psychiatrists or other folks that might be involved in these kids' lives.
Do you have a waiting list of people who want to see you, or are you feeling like you're in a good sort of stable position in terms of the need that's being met?
I don't have a waiting list. I prefer not to. And when people say I will wait, I will say I'm not worth waiting for. And I sort of mean that slightly tongue in cheek. But I think sometimes what happens if people wait a particularly long time to see somebody, their expectations of what's going to happen in that relationship go up as well. So I will often say, you know, why don't you, do you have other names? Why don't you try them? See how that goes. If for some reason the connection isn't good, certainly give me a call back and see if I'm available.
And Rick Barnett, do you think there are enough private practitioners out there to meet the need for people who are looking for counseling of all kinds?
I believe there are. I think the workforce issue is a complicated one, and I certainly believe there are a number of us who work in private practice that can take on more patients and can meet the need. But I think it's more also having to do with attracting more people to the field and also shuffling our roles a little bit, being more flexible in what we do.
How do you feel, Dr. Barnett, that private practitioners fit into this system that I described, that Governor Shumlin, you know, he was faced and forced to deal with the closure of the state hospital. His system, as he sees it, is that there's a limited number of beds that are available to people who are in crisis, and many of them are also within the justice system, that they're in the prison system. How do you see in the community picture and the outpatient treatment system the private practitioners fitting in?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind when you frame the question that way, that that certainly points to a specific population. And a lot of people who are in the population that you're describing certainly do fit into the private practice model because there are expectations that people who are discharged from inpatient get immediate follow-up care, whether that's in a designated agency or in a private practice. And private practitioners can continue the stabilization of those patients. Same thing coming out of incarceration. However, I think it's important to remember that most Vermonters are not that population, that they're people like you and me. They're politicians, they're lawyers, doctors, they're plumbers, teachers, people that work in various settings that are employed and functioning but still struggling a lot. And those are the people that I think that if the private practice system doesn't get integrated more effectively, run the risk of not having the services that they expect to have.
Why? Why can't they just find you as things stand now?
Well, part of the great thing about being on the show is that it points out that we are an invisible workforce, and we are absolutely at the table. We are not on the menu, but it does feel like sometimes that we are on the menu because we are so invisible. We have a seat at the table. We play a vital role in delivering these services to Vermonters of all kinds, but oftentimes, for many reasons, we get overlooked. People do seek mental health care privately, and I think a lot of times the rhetoric is that most people who get their mental health care get so in private practice settings by a primary care physician giving them an antidepressant. That's considered mental health treatment, and that's not the case.
So the case is what? That most people are getting private mental health care from private mental health practitioners?
I would say yes. I mean, Kevin just said so, and I said so. About 30, I see 35, 40 patients a week. I'm one solo practitioner. There's 800 plus of us who work in part-time or full-time private practice who see anywhere between 10 and 40 patients a week. That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, what do you think about Rick's assessment that sometimes private practitioners are overlooked when we think about mental health care in the big picture?
Well, we have such an odd job. We sit in rooms with the door closed all day long. And we can't talk about our jobs with other people, so it is a very sort of unique profession in that way, and so in that vein, I think it's been hard at times for, I'll speak for mental health counselors specifically, to be better advocates for themselves in the larger mental health and healthcare profession, and also sort of the work we do. It's pretty heavy work, and so we tend to sort of share it with colleagues who appreciate and understand the work more than anybody else, and so we're sort of a little more insular, I think, than some other professions might be. You know, it's funny if you go to a party and someone says, what do you do for a living? And you say, you're a psychotherapist. They say, oh, all right, well, I better go because you're going to now analyze me. I think people don't really necessarily understand that we're pretty regular folks and we meet primarily with regular folks who are struggling with one or more aspects of their home or work or parenting life.
That strikes me as a little different than what you're saying, Rick. It sounds like you think the state doesn't do enough to integrate private practitioners into the system. How do you mean?
I can vouch for that because I've been, like I said, at the table of many healthcare reform discussions at a very high level of leadership. And there's no question that there's lots of lip service done to the importance of private practitioners and that the linkages ought to be made. But the medico-centric system that we have around credentialing standards and designating agencies and patient-centered medical homes, it's a very insular model in that sense, and that while they feel they can't handle the capacity, they don't have the capacity to handle the mental health patients that they have in those systems, they also, that's the only system that they have to work with, that they need, they're forced to work with, I think, in healthcare reform efforts to try to help those patients. And I think private practitioners are a second or third tier priority for them. But, you know, a lot of people say it's extremely important to make those linkages, but it's just not happening.
Well, we're talking today about the mental health care system, and we're talking with two mental health care providers in private practice who are giving us a sense of what it's like to work in private practice, lots of patients seeing people, seeing therapists, seeing counselors, for everything from issues with family life to dealing with bipolar disorder. If you are a counselor or a psychologist in private practice, we'd love to know how you see your role in the system, how you feel like you fit in, and what you think the value is of having therapists and counselors in our communities. If you maybe see one and you want to tell us from your perspective what it's meant to you in your life, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And we got a note from Mark who says, what are the demographics of the patients that seek out private mental health practitioners? How do they differ from those that are treated through the state programs? And how reliant are the private practitioners on Medicaid dollars to make ends meet? Or do they operate more on an out-of-pocket basis? All right, so those are a couple different questions. Let's take the first two first. And Kevin, I'll go to you. What are the demographics of the patients and how do they differ from those patients who are treated through state programs?
Well, the community mental health agencies around the state sort of tend to work with patients or clients that have multi-systemic issues. There may be poverty issues. There may be multiple mental health and substance abuse issues. There might be multi-generational issues like abuse or domestic violence in the family. So by the time someone, you know, becomes a client of a community mental health agency, they've probably struggled for an incredibly long time. That being said, that doesn't mean that they don't seek private practitioners as well, but they sometimes need more wraparound services. So I think this is sort of where a state system and a private system sort of work well together, that sort of I will have clients sometimes whose services, whose needs start expanding beyond what I can offer. And so then I work with the agencies here in Burlington to sort of get them more services. Similarly, there are people that get really good treatment at the Community Mental Health Center and don't need that level of care anymore. And so the Community Mental Health Centers reach out to private practitioners and have them continue the ongoing work with the client. So I'm hesitant to use a word like less severe, but probably maybe the demographics are private practitioners perhaps see less multi-problem clients.
I want to address something that you sometimes hear or that I've heard sometimes in my reporting as just sort of a side comments from practitioners in the state system who say, yeah, you know, private providers, they treat the people with – they do say, you know, sometimes less severe issues until they can't handle it, and then they just pass them off on to us. So – it may be that that's how the system is designed, that there's a system that private practitioners do treat patients who are either less severe or less of an immediate harm to themselves or others, mm-hmm. whereas then the state system takes over. But Rick, would you assess it that way? I mean, there sometimes seems to be a little bit of tension in that statement, like, oh, they just treat the people that they think, you know, it seems to be this sense of upper middle class people with upper middle class problems until it's a real problem, and then we take the people who are serious.
Yeah, I disagree with that pretty strongly. I'm collecting my thoughts here for a second. Going back to the question that was written in, what percentage of my patients are out of pocket or Medicaid or commercial insurance? So I virtually have no out of pocket people, maybe one or two in any given week out of 35 or 40. I'd say about 30 to 40% of my patients are Medicaid, and then the rest are commercial insurance. You know, I can give you an example. Someone who, a 19-year-old who has a suicidal episode, contacts Emergency Crisis Services, a community mental health agency service, gets stabilized, gets assessed, gets stabilized, gets referred to me within, you know, 24, 48 hours. I sit down with them. They're stable. They're not suicidal anymore. I talk to them for a week or two and then maybe get them into rehab, or they continue to see me twice a week or three times a week to stabilize. That person could go to a community mental health agency, or they could come to see me and stabilize. I don't think it's pass the complicated people off to the community mental health agency, or But I do agree with what Kevin said somewhat. We can work very well together. It isn't a tit for tat kind of thing.
Or an either or.
Either or, right.
Let's go to Jacob, who's calling in from Barrie City. Hi, Jacob. Go right ahead.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we got you loud and clear.
Great. I think the point of the comment that you read and the reason why I'm calling in, I feel like the question was dodged. Will you recognize that the role of private practice in this mental health field, serving a slightly different demographic, trying to work in conjunction with the state, but in relation to the nation's and this state's health crisis, the mental health crisis, in the very beginning, when the folks on the show said, there's so many other people, it's the teachers, it's the lawyers, it's the this, it's the that, and nobody would disagree that every individual struggles, but it's the drug addicts, it's the people who don't have jobs, it's the people who have Medicaid or who can't even get on Medicaid. I'd like to hear them talk about what they're doing in terms of community outreach, in terms of just anything besides making a profit off of people's problems.
Jacob, thanks for your call. I appreciate your perspective, and I can hear your frustration. And Rick, I'd love for you to address that because you do treat people who are going through addiction, drug and alcohol addiction. And Jacob's, I think, concern and frustration is he feels like there's a profit motive here. What do you think?
To be honest, I do run a business. I don't know how profitable it is. It is still a struggle with reimbursement rates declining as we go along. That was one of the reasons why I got on the show. Group therapy reimbursement rates have been slashed and are going to be slashed again, which is devastating, reducing access for people like substance abusers, domestic violence, people suffering from domestic violence, sex offenders who need treatment and are mandated to treatment by the state. I don't think it's a profit motive at all. But we see all kinds of people. I have, like I said, 30 to 40% of my practice is alcohol or opioid related treatment. And it's working in conjunction with physicians, with community mental health agencies, the MAT teams. And so I don't know. You could say the same thing about the urine testing companies. It's all profit motive. You could say the same thing about the hub and spoke model. It's all profit motive for the pharmaceutical company. I would disagree with that.
On your website, Rick, I think it says that your general fee is about $150. Some of that's covered by insurance, but you operate on a sliding scale. Do you see any patients that for free or for very low cost?
Occasionally, when people's insurance runs out, it's unethical to drop them. So I will see people for several sessions to figure out how to move forward. I do have a sliding scale. The $150 fee is set as a set fee, and those people who can afford that fee for the initial assessment, which is a little bit more time intensive, and then a lot of people. I do negotiate my fee.
Kevin, what do you hear in Jacob, and what would you respond?
Yeah, I appreciate Jane you saying sort of like you can hear the frustration because I do think people can get very frustrated with mental health services and where to access them and whether they're in the right place or the wrong place. But in terms of the profiting, I sort of think, there's a difference between profit and paycheck. Rick and I don't get a paycheck, and so insurance reimbursement is our paycheck. So I guess if we call a paycheck a profit, then I guess, it would fall in the profit category. I think in terms of community outreach, I do a lot of workshops and presentations to schools and to parenting groups as a way to sort of remind people that, there are professionals out here in your community that can help you when times are hard. And Rick would probably agree, oftentimes we see people when their lives are somewhat problem saturated. Things have gotten really, really bad. And then they've tried a bunch of things and been unsuccessful. And then that's, the shape they arrive in our place. But I can say in my practice, I take clients without even knowing their ability to pay. So if someone calls and says, do you have any openings? I say, yes, I have an opening next Monday at 11. Could I take that time? I say, sure. And then I say, do you have insurance? If they say yes, I say, what kind? And then I verify that I accept it. And if they say, I don't have insurance, say, all right, well, let's talk about that when we meet on Monday. whether it's a sliding fee scale or maybe they are eligible for some kind of insurance, but they don't know how to access the information to make that happen. So sometimes, you know, our jobs are to sort of help people get connected to the kind of resources that they need so that they can benefit from more services.
We're talking today about mental health care in private practice, and we're hearing from a couple of practitioners who can help us understand how they operate and how they fit into the system. When we come back from our break, we're going to hear from a couple of practitioners who are calling in who have perspectives as well, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that insurance issue. How are practitioners reimbursed when you don't have that negotiation that a big hospital can have, or when we're talking about something that's often a therapy, you know, designed where you're talking to people? How do insurance companies reimburse for that? And what's happening with reimbursement? Sounds like it's not good from the practitioner's standpoint. If you want to weigh in on this, our number is 1-800-639-2211. And that number again, 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking about private practitioners who treat people with mental health concerns, everything from marriage and family counseling to treatment of bipolar disorder. And we're trying to get a better understanding of how they fit into the overall picture for healthcare in the state of Vermont. Our guests are Dr. Rick Barnett, a licensed psychologist and alcohol and drug counselor in Stowe, and Kevin Gallagher, a licensed clinical mental health counselor in Burlington. And if you have an experience to share, or if you work in the field yourself, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We'd love to hear from you. Randy is calling in from Hardwick. Hi, Randy. Go right ahead.
Hello. This is Randy Baupin.
Hi.
Can I talk now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'm a licensed clinical mental health counselor in Hardwick, which is part of the Northeast Kingdom. And I first wanted to talk about kind of the demographics of my client base. I mainly see young people, children and adolescents. And most of my referrals come through directly from parents or schools. I have a strong interactive relationship with schools, local community health, so Lamoille County Community Health and Northeast Kingdom, and DCF too. And so I was really mainly addressing, first of all, the comment about private practitioners seeing middle class, say the working, some people call it the working well. Working well. But anyway, because my client, with my experience, I'm seeing a lot of very needy young people who have experienced trauma, who have experienced a lot of anxiety, ADHD related issues, violence, and addiction issues. And I am really concerned about the current cuts. I think Rick Barnett will probably recognize my name as someone we've been communicating, especially the current cuts in group therapy. Because myself and a lot of practitioners provide group therapy, to our clients, and which means you've got to have a dedicated space, and that comes with a cost. Ms. Gallagher talked about the business of, you know, we'll receive insurance money, but then there's a lot of cost to running our business. And with the current cuts in group therapy, it's going to be very difficult to provide group therapy, which is a great way to work, especially with young people. I know some people who work with mandated sex offenders in group therapy. I work with young people. It's a great opportunity to work with communication with, and I use actually music as my therapeutic medium, but to develop communication, social skills.
Randy, thanks for your call. Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I want to double back to that question of reimbursement rates and cutting reimbursement rates for group therapy. But just before we do, let's get a call in here from Sue. Hi, Sue. You're on the air. Go right ahead. Sue, you there? All right. We'll see if we can get Sue on the line.
This is Dr. Sue Deppe.
Yes.
Hello?
Hi. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I'm a private practice psychiatrist in Colchester, and I love what I do. I do both medications and assessments as well as a lot of psychotherapy. I have a small practice, but certainly, I also am on the Vermont Psychiatric Association Executive Committee, and we're in that unique position of being both mental health professionals and physicians. Private psychiatric practice is an incredibly valuable treatment option for a lot of people, and we're also a resource for other mental health clinicians who we often work with, as well as physicians and clergy and so on. But our numbers have been decimated over the last 25 or 30 years. When I was in training in Burlington in 87 to 90, there were gobs of private practice psychiatrists around, and now people are desperate to find folks, and there aren't very many of us. And child psychiatry has been that way for probably 25 or 30 years. Adult psychiatry has been that way for a number of years, and it's really sad. And I do have thoughts about why few psychiatrists may be entering private practice from talking to a few colleagues. Part of it is a poor reimbursement from commercial insurers who have really devalued what we do, not only what our therapist colleagues do, which is incredibly valuable, but what we do, whether we're doing therapy or medication, and sometimes tried to turn us into sort of medication mills. We tracked a long period of time, and I don't have the exact number of years, but for many, many, many years, one major insurer in Vermont didn't change what they paid us at all. It doesn't matter what you put down on the claim. Difficulty getting the reimbursement that's even theoretically possible because of the hassles of managed care or doing drug pre-authorizations, which can take a huge amount of time so the patient can get their meds, but you don't get paid for any of that. It wastes your time. Medicare and Medicaid have relatively poor reimbursement, and many of our folks and the folks that are seeing other clinicians are on those because there's a strong association between major mental illness and disability or poverty. And I do want to acknowledge that Vermont's Medicaid program I've been reasonably happy with. It's a lot better than many other states, but I'm not the sole income for my family.
So you're really picking up on exactly what we want to talk about here, and I appreciate you calling in, and I appreciate hearing from a psychiatrist because, as you mentioned, there certainly is a shortage of psychiatrists in Vermont, especially in more rural areas, and that's a big issue for people and a big issue for the community mental health centers as well. I appreciate your call. If you're in private practice and you want to weigh in, our number again, 1-800-639-2211. Hillary in Barrie says, I work in a hub with clients who are opioid dependent, many of whom are on Medicaid. My annual salary is less than $32,000 with a master's degree. In order to get licensed as a drug and alcohol counselor, I have to spend additional money for continuing education, exams, and state licensing fees. My employer's health insurance is expensive and has a high deductible. While I appreciate Vermont's approach to opioid dependence, the profession of drug and alcohol counseling is lagging far behind others in terms of compensation and does not offer a livable wage for people who have invested in education and training. Hillary, thank you for that comment. So, Rick and Kevin, let's go to this question of insurance reimbursement, because insurance reimbursement is a complicated issue whenever we discuss it. But when you're talking about therapy, how does reimbursement work? I mean, how do they even determine what an appropriate price or what an appropriate payment would be? Kevin, I'll start with you.
Well, you're assuming someone has figured out an appropriate price. this is sort of be somewhat boring. But sort of, different therapy have different procedure codes, and those procedure codes for commercial as well as federal and state insurance plans, those procedure codes match up with a particular fee. And there are different fees for master's level people, doctorate level people, and the physician level. And so if you're seeing a group, then you use the group fee. If you're seeing an individual fee. If you're seeing a family, the family fee. If you're seeing a couple, it's metrics. But your larger question is sort of like, who determines what is fair and equitable reimbursement? And I'm not quite sure there's a lot of thinking that goes into that. Most of the insurance companies, at least that I've been working with for the last 25 years, maybe one has had a $2 session increase. Most of the others have stayed flat or gone down.
How does that impact what you're doing, Kevin?
Well, I haven't done it lately, it usually is too depressing. From 2000 to 2010, my income went down every year, except for 2008. I don't know why. Maybe that was because the recession started then. But that being said, I have to see more people each year in the course of the year to even make last year's income. And so when I think of things about my office rent, utilities, insurance, health insurance as well as liability insurance, and then things like continuing education, it is pretty expensive to be in private practice, which is why a lot of people like agency work, because I want to get a paycheck and not be anxious about my income.
So, Rick, where do you come in on this? I mean, this is clearly a big issue for anybody who's trying to make a living doing this and relying on insurance reimbursements.
Well, I just want to go back to how that figure gets calculated. It's very complicated. It is a formula that's put out by Medicare, who sets the standards for fees. It's called RBRVS. It's very complicated. They look at what goes into the work of a health provider. And if we don't use expensive machines like MRIs and stuff, which get valued at a much higher level, we use our brains. That's why we are the instrument. And so they tend to devalue that. It's not an actual physical medical instrument that's being used. And so that's why the reimbursement rates have been going down, that the value placed on sort of cognitive mental, using your personhood as a variable in calculating the formula gets devalued. But I want to make sure that we get back to what this is really about. And this is about access to care and choice for patients. Patients want to have a choice of where to seek their mental health care. They can get that in a community mental health agency. They can be in crisis and go inpatient. They can get that from a private practitioner. But if things continue the way they are, with reimbursement rates declining for private practitioners, and the system unfolding the way it is, everything being monopolized by ACOs and hospitals and everything being focused there, then patients are left with limited access and limited choice in where they get their mental health care. And that's really, I think, what this is about. I want to recognize also the legislature, because if it wasn't for some serious advocacy on behalf of private practitioners, we wouldn't have been able to get in the recent healthcare budget that was passed, S-139, and we did receive a 1% increase for Medicaid dollars. But the group reimbursement rates is a separate issue, and that has been declining, and that's going to continue to decline, which is a major issue that we're going to tackle in the coming months.
Because you see group therapy as a valuable way to treat people, and it seems to be devalued in the system?
Incredibly. Yes, it's incredibly valuable, and it's incredibly valuable to people. That's why peer recovery services have been exploding, 12-step programs. People really value the group therapy format, and if it's run by a professional, facilitated professionally, it can be very beneficial for people across settings. And private practice, is just another setting where that can take place.
Dr. Rick Barnett is a licensed psychologist and an alcohol and drug counselor in Stowe. Kevin Gallagher is a licensed clinical mental health counselor in Burlington. Thanks to both of you for talking to us a little bit about what private practice is like and where you see some tension points. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Jane.
That's great for being here.
Coming up, another angle on health and well-being. Vermont was recently granted $3 million in federal money to go towards opiate addiction treatment. We'll talk with the head of a clinic in Rutland that's getting some of that money. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier this month, it was announced that Vermont will receive a $3 million grant for opioid addiction treatment. The new money means that some addiction treatment centers will be able to expand options for patients who need it most. We're joined now by Dr. Jeffrey McKee. He's director of psychiatric services at the Rutland Regional Medical Center, which runs the West Ridge Center for Addiction Recovery. Dr. McKee, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Vermont is one of 11 states getting a chunk of this federal money to help treat opioid addiction. And in Vermont, Rutland, Addison, Chittenden, and Franklin counties are targeted for funds. How much is your center going to get?
I believe our center, which is includes services to both Rutland and Addison County under the grant, is receiving about $200,000 a year for the 3 years. But we hope it goes 3 years. It's guaranteed for the first year, and then it has to be renewed for the subsequent 2 years. But we're hopeful on the 3-year funding.
And what strings are attached to this money?
So we have the program comes with expectations that we deliver services to underserved and high-risk populations, and you know, we there's a number of measures we'll do to demonstrate the effectiveness of those services and so forth. And Dartmouth-Hitchcock is helping us collect that data and establish you know, the kinds of measures that we'll report on. But in Rutland and Addison counties, the primary group of high-risk population that we decided to focus on is folks coming out of corrections and subsequently under the supervision of probation and parole.
Talk a little bit more about that, how you're going to target the $200,000 you hope each $200,000 for 3 years, how you hope to target that money on that population.
So there's the biggest piece of the funding and the effort goes to supporting a clinical case or a care manager who will work with corrections and probation and parole to identify folks who will be reentering our communities. So that
and when you
we
say supporting that position, you mean hiring somebody to do that?
Oh yes, I'm sorry. Yes, we'll be hiring somebody to do that work. That person will be able to do assessments while the person is still in corrections, and so that we understand their clinical needs, their substance abuse needs, their mental health treatment needs, as well as you know, their primary care, housing, vocational needs before they come out. And so rather than coming out to the community and getting on a wait list for services someplace, they can come out into the community and get services immediately hopefully reduce significantly the chances of them reentering the correction system.
My understanding go ahead. Did you want to continue?
I was just going to say that person will between Rutland and Addison counties, will be pulling together into interdisciplinary teams from primary care offices, the federally qualified health centers, DCF, probation and parole, and all the other treatment providers to work with. Over the 3 years, we hope to serve about 125 patients in each of the areas of the state.
The federal money, the grant money, my understanding is that partly it's trying to get more money into medication-assisted treatment. Does that mean just what it sounds like, treating addiction problems at least partially with medication?
Right. So at the work in Rutland is really focused around the Westridge Center, which is a in the state's language a medication-assisted treatment hub, which means we're kind of the center for medication-assisted treatment, which includes methadone and buprenorphine, and so it will help folks in those high-risk populations get connected to those services, as well as to expand our offering of a medication called naltrexone, it also goes by the brand name Vivitrol, which blocks the opiate receptors in the brain, so someone getting that medication doesn't feel the euphoric effect of the opiate that they had been taking previously, and it also helps reduce cravings. And so that's an offering that we're looking forward to being able to offer to this population, but through this experience also be able to offer other folks in our community.
Because methadone and buprenorphine often get the most press, I think naltrexone might be something that's new to people's ears. And so you talk about how it works, that it, you know, I think you said it attaches to the receptors in the brain. It doesn't allow somebody to get high. But my understanding is that it's also not an effective treatment for somebody who right now is, say, a heroin user and is actively using the drug. This is something that's specifically or more appropriately geared towards someone who's gone through withdrawal and is trying to make sure that they stay clean?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So because of the way the naltrexone works, if someone is actively using opiates and they start taking naltrexone, it could immediately throw them into significant withdrawal symptoms and almost perpetuating a relapse, if you will, as a result of taking it while they're still using other opiates. So it is ideally suited for folks who have been clean for a significant amount of time from opiates. And the people coming out of corrections, of course, would be ideally suited for that as a medication intervention rather than methadone and buprenorphine. Although some will be more appropriate for methadone and buprenorphine if the for a number of clinical factors, including their level of previous abuse and dependence, how long they've been clean, and you know how bad their cravings are, which are highly variable.
We on this program have also talked with Dr. Stacy Sigmund, who's been piloting a program that uses a thing called a Med-O-Wheel that dispenses medication like Suboxone or methadone on a timed release and is designed to help people who are on waiting lists for treatment at a center. Is that something that you would look into?
So I know that the Chittenden Center, I believe, in Burlington is looking at that as part of their interventions. And so we didn't include that in Rutland and Addison counties as part of what we had planned, but certainly we'll watch their success and think about doing that in Rutland if they can work out the bugs and the supervision of all that is something to consider.
Dr. McKee, how important to you and to your center is this money that you're getting?
Well, it's very significant. It's significant for the Rutland and Addison counties in terms of the 125 patients we're going to serve, but also the ripple effects that this has. I think we're going to gain expertise in working with the corrections population as well as how to do Vivitrol that'll serve the rest of our communities, and as well as the clinical training that's a part of the grant as well that our staff will receive on best practices from the training that will be supplied by the folks at Dartmouth is just really going to enhance the programming that we can offer to all of our patients. So I think between the enhancements to our programming and helping a significant number of folks establish stable recovery, it's big for our entire community.
Dr. Jeffrey McKee, he's Director of Psychiatric Services at the Rutland Regional Medical Center, which runs the West Ridge Center for Addiction Recovery. He's been explaining how his clinic will use their portion of the $3 million in federal money coming into Vermont for opioid addiction treatment. Dr. McKee, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
There have been a lot of sewage spills lately, and the state reports them on a website when it becomes aware of an overflow from a municipal sewage system. But it can be really hard to find out where those overflows are, and the state has no real-time alert to let people know when a spill has happened and water might be contaminated. VPR has been reporting on this problem all summer, so our own web developer, Sarah Simon, got on the case, and she's created a Twitter bot. Sarah, hi, tell us what that actually means, what a Twitter bot actually is.
Hi, Jane, sure. So twice a day, this Twitter bot takes a look at the water waste inventory site for Vermont to see if there are any new spills. If there are, it will tweet those. And if not, it sends me an email that's basically, hi, I checked, there's nothing new to tweet, so that I know that the Twitter bot is still checking, it's still working, and nothing's broken. So basically, if there is a new spill on the site that's reported, the Twitter bot takes the important information from that spill and formats it into a 140-character tweet that then is sent out to everybody who follows the Dirty Water VT Twitter handle.
If it's checking twice a day and then telling you, hey, Sarah, no worries, all's cool here, that sounds almost nefarious, like you've created some superhuman. I mean, we even call it a bot.
Yes. The only reason I have it do that is because I didn't want to just be wondering, okay, I'm not seeing any new tweets. I have no idea if this is either working and there are no new spills or if it's completely broken. So I wanted that peace of mind to be able to say, okay, all's good. I don't need to worry about anything. The bot is working according to plan.
Is twice a day enough, do you think?
That's a good question. Now, twice a day is certainly more than what the water waste inventory site is sending to everybody because they're not sending anything. So I've tested with a lot of different times of day, and I've tested with, you know, 4 or 5 times a day, which would obviously be ideal, right, to get this news out as fast as possible. But the thing with technology is that servers can't necessarily handle that much interaction from our site to theirs, and twice a day seems like it's the best fit to keep everything running.
All right, tell us honestly, Sarah, you actually took down their server?
I'm not totally sure. So I did something. It was running, I think, maybe like 20 minutes, you know, every 20 minutes. And because I wanted this to be, you know, as close to a real-time thing as I could. And all of a sudden, I got an error message back that said, you cannot scrape this anymore. And I took a look at their site, and their site was not up. And Oops. But you know what? I turned the bot off and their site came back on in a few minutes. So I still to this day, it might have been a coincidence.
Yeah. And if people are not programmers and they just want to follow the bot and find out when there might be a sewage overflow in Vermont that might affect them and where they swim or recreate, where do they find it?
Now, that's on the Twitter website and the handle is DirtyWaterVT.
That's VPR web developer Sarah Simon. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thanks, Jane.
All right, and tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll tackle the issue of whether or not Vermont needs an ethics commission to review possible conflicts of interest within state government. For years, many lawmakers insisted that Vermont was immune from the kinds of problems that have emerged in other states. But now there's growing support for a plan to create an ethics commission. Let us know what you think about the idea. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in tomorrow. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Sarah Matthews. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.